I want to hear about what you actually think about laundromats,
Are you?
because there's someone big on, you know, the top or like the social media, the podcast rounds that talks about how laundromats are an incredible kind of like drug gateway business into ETA and buying businesses and stuff. So why not laundry businesses?
Why not laundry businesses? I think it's really hard. I think most of the people that I know who talk about laundry businesses are making their money talking about laundry businesses, not operating laundry businesses.
Actually, wait, both. Why? Isn't that just like what are so fixed assets, probably like 30, 50K down.
What are you
You
calling a
buy a
fixed
bunch of
asset?
machines
What's a fixed
and
asset? You're
then
calling the machines fixed assets?
the
Okay,
washers and
equipment,
dryers.
sure.
Equipment. And okay, so you put that down, maybe 100K to start. And then I don't know how much they make at laundry places, like maybe it's $1 a person or so, or $2 per person. But is it just like any of your revenue is being wiped out by utilities like water costs and electricity costs?
Here's my issue with laundromats. My rule is you should only do something that if you're right, you get rich, and if you're wrong, you don't go broke. And I've never seen a single location laundromat ever. First of all, dry cleaners, it's important to make the distinction between laundromats and dry cleaners, because dry cleaners are
Yeah.
like an unmitigated disaster in most cases, just because you have such an issue with how they impact the real estate with the chemicals that you use in a dry cleaners. So laundromats are a separate thing. Buying a laundromat, I've never seen a laundromat deal that is doing well enough on its own in order for you to make enough money to really do anything with and quit your job or anything like that. And so then the next thing that people tend to go to when there's like one unit of something that sucks, and then they think that if they add 5 units of something that suck, that you end up with something that doesn't suck. And it just like, it never works that way. Because one laundry unit, say that in the best case scenario, you put 100 grand down, whatever, 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 and it nets you 50 grand a year. So that's amazing. So you make 4 grand a month, but you don't have enough money in the business to not show up at the laundromat whenever the washer and dryers are broken and somebody slipped and
Yeah.
fell, or somebody got knifed in the laundromat at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you got to go take a police report. Like, that's all the shit that happens in this brick and mortar stuff. I've been in it, and I
Yeah.
saw this with the yogurts.
So are no washer, no, none of these laundromats are
No, I
making
think that they
money.
make money, but I think when you're looking at a business that nets 100 grand a year, call it best case scenario, you net 100 grand a year doing it, you can't pay somebody enough to not be in the operations of that business. And so you buy yourself a time liability. You buy yourself like a job that you're going to have to do and dedicate and allocate resources to over and over and over again. And so it's not like a passive income thing. There's just not enough income there for you to get out of the ops of it. And so for me, the definition of an asset is something that generates free cash flow in excess of paying for its own management. So it needs to make enough money
Yeah.
in order, enough money in excess of the management of it.
Correct. The gross margin needs to cover the
Yeah,
operating
well,
expenses.
the net profit needs to be,
Not including
if you put
time
any
of
of
a
your
whole
time into
employee.
it, then you have an issue. I have friends that did, it's kind of like buying a single family house that you expect to rent out, and like your mortgage is $1,800 and you make $2,500 a month in rent, and all of that pencils until the refrigerator breaks and it costs you 6 grand, and then you're making your 250 grand at a job, and then you realize that to go and deal with your tenant, my lawyer buddy, he bought a house. He bought two houses, and one of the houses had bed bugs that the tenant made him fix. He was making 350 grand as a 6th or 7th year associate at a law firm, and then he would have to spend his weekends to go and try to make an extra 500 or 600 bucks a month in quote unquote passive income, because he read an article about it on BiggerPockets.
But what about like the rich dad, poor dad thing of like, okay, you're buying assets,
But
right?
it's
And it's slowly going to accumulate. I think it is a long-term play,
not an asset if
but
it can't afford for its own management outside of your time. Like a
okay.
single family house, you may call it an asset because it sits on an asset on a balance sheet, and you have the asset and the liability, owner's equity. So you can call that an asset. I think when you're buying a leasehold in a laundromat, like the leasehold is a liability, and the equipment may be assets that are depreciating quickly, and you hope that it generates free cash flow. I would do a laundromat deal if somebody says, I'm a whiz bang operator of these laundromats and I'm going to buy 50 of them and I'm going to be the operator of them and I'm going to dedicate the rest of my life to this. I think that's where a laundromat deal makes sense. I think to go and buy your local laundromat, which is almost always in the hood, and you go from your day job working at an investment bank to drive into the hood to make sure that you can collect your $47 a quarters on a Friday night. It's like, what are we talking about here? What are we actually talking about here?
Yeah. No,
better to be in no deal than to be in a bad deal. Just like it's better to be single than it is to be in a bad marriage. And so a lot of times people are so antsy to do something, to feel like they're building some escape route from their job, that like they're pull the trigger on something because they watched a TikTok video about how they're the greatest things ever and you can get in for 20 grand and seller financing and you can do all of the things. But I think what you ultimately get to is like, if the deal that you're doing can't get you rich, and what people will justify is like, well, this is like a stepping stone to get me rich. I'm going to get my first laundromat done. So that way, 10 years down, I'm going to own 1,000 of them. I just think most people can't cross that chasm. Yeah, you have to be stoked about going and getting the $46 a quarters on the Friday night. And if you have that level of dedication to go and pick up the $47 on a Friday night a quarters, then you will crush it so much more in an opportunity that has like more inherent leverage in it and less inherent constraint to scale.
Yeah.
And so even if you're down to do it, even if you're down to grind it out, I think you're better off doing something that isn't so naturally constrained based on what the business looks like. I mean, my grandparents were in the laundromat business. They had a laundromat for 20 years. They demolished it. They razed it to the ground. And just had vacant land that they decided to rent out to fireworks operators for the 4th of July and Christmas instead of operating a coin laundromat laundry. Because like you're dealing with rough people that can be
too much for too little type of thing. Like it's too much of a drain mentally, time wise.
If you're 18 years old and you're not going to college and that's what you want to do, I think that's great. But I think the typical demo of like somebody who's a professional, who's like looking for side income as a way to kind of like build an escape route from their corporate professional job that they're making six figures in, I think that you're better off to pick a bigger opportunity to go for than like the little side hustle thing.
That can generate more cash flow. Yeah. So I guess that goes off the principle of like sometimes people say that like it's worth always doing a bigger deal than a smaller deal because you're going to spend the same amount of time, but at least you have more kind of cash flow and leverage on the bigger deal.
For sure, I think it's okay to do a smaller deal if it's something that if you're right, you get rich. If you being perfectly right about a single location coin laundry, I haven't seen a deal like that, that like if you're right, you get rich on it. And if you can't get rich on it, if you can't get rich on it, why do the deal? And if it's a laundromat that you can get rich on, then it's going to be priced properly. You know what I mean? It's going to be priced in an expensive way. And I've just been in the brick and mortar game enough to know like that level of clientele requires a low level employee and it's in low level areas. And it's just, you end up
becomes like an operational nightmare.
Yeah. You just end up dealing with all these like pathological issues that exist in that socioeconomic strata. That's like life's too short. If you're trying to be Mother Teresa through owning and operating coin laundromats, then that's a different thing. But if you're trying to get rich,
that's a different thing. Yeah,
and you're trying to find the path of least resistance to get rich, I just don't think it's at least not the silver bullet that it's marketed to be.
Do you think it's better than buying single family houses one at a time?
Likely.
And having renters and them paying it off. So the laundromat,
I would probably,
like if you had a property manager that took, okay, maybe you don't cash flow anything, right? Like I know somebody who has a couple properties. He doesn't cash flow anything from them positively, but it's a kind of a break even, right? And a property management company takes
8% of the top line rent. Yeah,
exactly. Yep. And then Yeah. So I think his ultimate goal is, yes, in 30 years, they'll be paid off, right?
Yeah.
I know that's way too far out, but is that like the get rich slow tactic or?
Yeah, I think it's a bad option set. You know what I mean? You're giving me a false dichotomy. I pick neither of them. I don't want to do either of them. I think if you have W-2 income and you have a job, I would actually probably rather take the house that has no drag on my time than the laundromat that is never going to be able to afford management and will be a drag on my time. I would rather probably not be in either of them, but I'd rather be like completely passive and bet on equity appreciation somehow in the single family home situation. And hopefully you can refi into a cheaper mortgage like when rates normalize. I would rather do that than again, go to the coin laundry on a Friday night on date night with your wife.
That's the part that gets skimmed over
because it doesn't fit in a TikTok video, but that's the reality of it. Cause like I've had to do it in the trampoline parks, you know what I mean? I would probably rather take the thing that has no drag on time.
But people then get rich or do the cash, like they find their exit is when they cash out, right? So when you sell the equity or when you sell the real estate or when you sell the business. So if you're looking at it from that perspective, is the buy and hold strategy better for wealth creation, or eventually you need to sell to get, I guess, liquidate and get some chips off the table? But then what do you do with that excess cash? I guess most people don't have to worry about that right now. But even from like what's a realistic way for people to be able to actually get a bag, quote unquote, like make $1 million or $2 million from selling an asset?
I think the realistic way for most people is the assumption that they have a job that they're like working right now. And this is something that they're trying to do as a side hustle.
Yeah.
My biggest thing has always been find a way to invest in a local business that's already operating, that's already up and going. Find a way to add value and buy into that business and help them grow it and run it. In the escape room business, I actually had a sales guy that I offered him equity. I was going to make him buy into the business. And he decided that he didn't want to do that. We were going to give him 10% of the business, which would have been a couple hundred grand when the escape room portion sold. But he decided that he didn't want to do it, that he wanted to just get, you know, paid off of the sales that he had. And so I think finding a way in a local small business to get skin in the game based on what your unique expertise is probably like the most realistic way for everyday Joe to, you know, make seven figures and an exit to become a, you know, paper millionaire and ultimately a liquid millionaire by getting involved.
Yeah.
If you have a job that is very difficult for you to quit, I think the idea of acquiring something that requires your you to be there operationally is like super difficult to achieve for most people. And so I think finding a group of people and finding a way to be involved and to add value and be a small piece of the puzzle for them, but an essential piece. I think that's probably the best risk adjusted way to make life changing money.
Okay. That makes sense. And you would probably kind of put that in the $2 to $5 to $10 million range of an exit of, you know, what you consider like life changing money.
Yeah. I think for most people, $5 million is like that far exceeds expectations. I think a lot of people, if they have jobs, are hoping to make a couple $1 million and then put it in the stock market or whatever and make, you know, 5 to 8% on their money and live off of the returns of that capital in the stock market or whatever.
Unless they tried to do through Bitcoin 2 years ago. No, I know someone who got like, I think they kind of saved up almost like seven figures, like probably just $1 million or so, working a job for like 5, 7, 8 years, or like a pretty high paying job, bonuses, things like that. Might've been 10 years. And then they quit their job, I think, like at the peak of the market, like 2020, mid 2021. And I think they lost like more than probably $500,000.
Just in the stock market?
Because of the stock
market. Yeah, I know that the stock market is too liquid for me. I need something that locks my capital in and locks it in so that way I can't get it when I need it. I need something illiquid, which is why I don't play the stock market. But I think between stock market and Bitcoin and whatever, like there are a lot of people that got smashed on.
Yeah. Yeah.
So does that solve your laundromat quandary? Did I persuade you away?
Yeah, no,
did
I was just
you away from a local laundromat investment. No,
no,
I didn't persuade you away.
I would never do that. I was never interested in that. Because the thing is, I like the ability. I just like software or tech or online, yeah. Like remoteness. I know you obviously, Jay, like had a win in the local. So that's
it's
your
the
kind
opposite,
of thesis.
Though. I feel like. But anyway, keep going. I did a tweet on this about like
what you mean, yeah.
everyone talks about why boring businesses are so great, but like they're really not. The biggest issue with the boring business is two things. One is usually what a lot of these courses will talk about is buy a boring business, buy something that like you see a fax machine in the corner or that they've been keeping their books on sticky notes and you can automate the business and you can bring new technology to these businesses. The problem is technology is almost never the constraint that these businesses are facing. Like if you look at a landscaping business, they need labor. You have labor as the main constraint. And getting people to freaking show up and do their freaking job is the hardest part in these businesses. If you have a tree trimming service and it's booked out 3 months in advance, you don't need to move from sticky notes to an Airtable. You need more tree trimmers and no one wants to do the work. Yeah. And so labor is the biggest constraint typically in these. And the second thing is that the type of worker that you get in a boring business is typically a blue collar worker that is by definition not motivated or has no ambition or inclination to light the world on fire with what they're doing. And so it's very hard to incentivize them to get more, marginal labor out of them because like when it's at 5 o'clock,
correct.
They're like, I'm done for the day.
I'm out.
And so you get searchers or whoever else that are looking at these plumbing businesses. And once you own it, it's not a P&L that you can look at. It's a pipe full of shit that you have to go clean. If your master plumber decides that he wants to quit, you know what I mean? Or your journeymen aren't showing up or you can't hire a new journeyman to like be underneath the master plumber, whatever. The labor is the biggest constraint in these things typically. And it's very difficult. It's easy to look on a P&L and see how there's so much underutilization within the business and to put on your MBA optimization hat and say, I'm going to maximize utility within this thing by doing XYZ. But like the humans that are involved in the organization,
it's not realistic,
are not likely going to do that. And, you know, whatever, there's exceptions to every rule. I think it's the way that it's marketed online, just like everything, is oversimplified based on my experience of running boring businesses.
Yeah.
If you're more inclined to like more human intensive and like you like kind of being with the people and getting in their stories and like going to your employees' birthday parties and kind of it's very HR, you know, operationally intensive thing, which is great for people who aren't me.
Okay, that makes sense. How about, so then home care business?
Home care like
though?
What? Like landscaping and that kind of thing?
No. Sorry. Health home care, like nursing, old people.
Hospice? Hospice is like a legit one, right?
I guess, but I think hospice is like, and the problem is, I don't know if I would want to do a business where like you're dealing with like death and stuff.
I mean, the investors that I had in the trampoline park business, some of the investors, they were in the home health, home hospice business. As I've moved to a more investor seat from an entrepreneur operator seat, we were just talking about this at lunch today. Like a mistake that I've made on a couple deals that I've ended up passing on is the fear of having to operate the business, right? When I look at the business, I think it's been so seared into me as the operator of a relatively sized business. Like, so when you tell me home hospice, and I'm like, jeez. I'm going to have to go wipe old people's butts. Like there's no amount of money that I'll do it for. And so, and I'm saying that's a flaw in my investor brain because it's the entrepreneur in me that has an aversion to the ops of the thing that I'm looking at, which is part of the reason why I only do deals not doing full buyouts is because I want the operator in there staying. And so all of those things, landscaping, laundromats, home hospice, I think that there's deals to be had there. Like I think once you start seeing studies in Harvard Business Review about how great the segment is, like it's already priced out. You know what I mean? Like, it's priced efficiently.
Did you see that?
Actually, I tried doing that with pest control. So, like, I was going to go do, I thought, like, nobody was going and doing, like, this pest control roll-up. I had a buddy who did a huge roll-up and, like, had an amazing exit. And just like, oh, I'm going to do the exact same thing. And thinking that these pest control owners didn't really know anything that I was trying to do. And so I was like, oh, like, these guys are going to be, like, so excited. I'm coming in. I'm going to be, like, their saving grace. And I'm going to come in and, hey, hand me over your business. You know, your kid doesn't want to run it. So, like, you know, these boomers that were, like, supposedly in this retirement age. Like, you know, everyone's heard the, maybe if you're on TikTok, like, and you're in the buying business core space. Like, you've heard, like, the, you know, big retirement age is coming. And so I go in and I start looking for these pest control businesses to go and acquire, like, start rolling up. And somehow, like, there was, like, a network. Like, everyone was in this network. Like, every pest control owner was following this exact same podcast, and they all knew what the strategy was, what everything was going on. So I came in thinking that, like, these people had no idea what a roll-up really was, what, like, these things were. And, like, they're like, oh, no, like, I've heard about this. It totally, like, went around on my back where I was like, oh, okay, this is a... It's not the newest thing. Like, everyone's already doing this already. And so I thought I'd come in and have, like, the same exit.
Yeah, yeah. But it's funny because the forces do kind of push that.
Oh, for sure. Like, that's what, you know, I had, like, a background in, like, lead gen for pest control. You know, I was like, oh, I'm going to go blow up a pest control business and get a whole bunch of leads. But back to, like, Raleigh's point, like, the constraint isn't, like, leads necessarily for some of them. Like, especially, like, the business that I want to buy. Like, unless I'm going to go buy, like, a bad business, like, they don't have leads. And so they need leads. There was a startup. I'm like, I don't want to do that. But I want, like, the businesses I was going to go try to go roll up were, like, you know, like, they've been since the 90s, and, like, they have big word of mouth. They have amazing, like, everyone knows what they are. And so I was going to go try to roll these up and, like, try to put technology inside it. And, like, it wouldn't have solved anything. It would just have been, like, create another problem. And so, like, the main problem is that constraint where it's, like, the actual work, like, the worker, like, the truck breaks down, or the worker decides to not go spray the house, or, you know, all this crazy stuff.
Like, I have a buddy that's been on the podcast before. I haven't actually followed up with him, but he bought a couple FedEx routes and he took a course on FedEx buying. He's a lawyer, real estate developer. And a couple months after he did it, I kind of just texted him and asked him how it was going. And he's like, it's a lot more operationally difficult than he thought it was going to be. Right.
Are these, like, those FedEx ground routes that you can buy on, like, BizBuy?
And there's one guy who bought a couple of these. And
could you give, like, a quick primer on what that is? Like, what does it actually mean? You're buying a route, like, you're making money from
FedEx,
shipping fees?
You're basically a subcontractor of FedEx.
Like, last mile delivery.
So FedEx will, like, fly the stuff to you, and then you are the one that goes and takes it all out to the routes. And so FedEx is your customer. You work for FedEx. They continue to set the prices, the rates, how much you make per mile, all that stuff. And so there's a guy that bought a couple of these FedEx routes, and then he built a course on buying FedEx routes, and he does consulting on FedEx routes. And, you know, like, I think what you find with a lot of these people is it's like the real estate seminar space. Most people who are talking about flipping single family homes make infinitely more money on the digital product, how to start a single family home flipping business, than they do in their actual home flipping business. Same with real estate wholesaling. And none of that's to say that it's nefarious or they got bad intentions. Just, like, you know, you have to start somewhere, and it's as good a place as any to start. The hard part about getting into a business like a laundromat business where you're signing a long-term lease is you're not set up very well for massive change in circumstances that can either happen in the economy, that can happen in your life, they can happen in any one of various different situations. You're not very anti-fragile. When I talked to him about the FedEx thing, the concern for me was, like, you know, FedEx kind of has you by the balls, and they have no real incentive to screw their contractors, but there's just risk there. And there's,
you don't have much control. It's like having your whole business on Amazon,
totally.
Or just,
I mean,
you know,
yeah, you have massive, like, platform risk.
Yeah.
So, like, how much can you actually do to, like, generate excess returns within the FedEx route thing? Like, you're kind of like FedEx determines your revenue. Then your whole game is trying to figure out how much you can cut costs and, you know, skimp on maintenance on the fleet, or, you know, cut drivers' pay, all of those things. I try to find businesses more and more that rely less and less on US labor. I think like the labor arbitrage thing of moving things overseas will be more and more prevalent. And so being in a business that requires a human to show up somewhere out of their house and watch a trampoline park or turn a pizza in an oven or drive something from point A to point B or build a fence or do any of that stuff. I just like,
but that's you saying this now after you've already had a life-changing experience from a business like that, business that you need to be there in person, you from the trampoline park. Is it just because now you're thinking of it from like an investor hat versus in the beginning, which is just like, hey, I gotta make this work. I gotta, you know, get the first bag, quote unquote, like get the first exit. You might be talking on the next level of, you know, entrepreneurship post once you've actually made
some. I think when I did the escape room business, my wife was doing a digital business in tandem. And the risk that I took to do a brick and mortar local business relative to the risk that she took to start posting something online, the risk reward ratio was so out of whack. Like hers was so much easier to do, easier to manage, easier to scale, easier to generate free cash flow from. And we did it in tandem. It was less capital intensive than my business was.
But how much was your trampoline park exit?
She got cancer, which wasn't a great thing for her personal brand.
Yeah, so then you're not.
But I'm saying, the start, going from zero to one, right? I was able to exit, but she was making $50,000 a month net profit, like within 6 to 7 months of starting. And for most people, if you're trying to just generate an extra $500,000 of free cash flow somehow, like I think that I would go to an online, to a digital business over a sweaty startup or a boring business or whatever those things are, just because I think it's harder. It's a harder business to run.
Yeah, that's why I was like, so that one guy came in the other day and he was talking to you about his RV business, right?
Yeah.
And like this RV business does like insane number, like 100 mil plus, but he said
in sales, like, annuals.
And then like the profit margin was like maybe 1%. It was like, you know,
1 to 3%
on that of 100 million sales. But he's like, the thing that when I heard it, I was like, oh, that sounds like it's miserable. It's like the actual, like the RV industry is so, so behind where like the way they get the parts, the way they do all these kind of things, there's like this crazy process of like, if I came in and bought that, like there's no way I would have had any idea. I'd be like, oh, like, I'll go online to like Home Depot or whatever they buy parts and like just buy a bulk. And he's like,
yeah, the operation is like,
I know I have every single different contractor where I know this guy can do this specific kind of part of the RV. And it's like, and the whole industry is like that, where if I'm coming in, I'm like, oh, like someone tells me to go buy an RV business and I see it does an amount of sales and, you know, the cash was like, oh, you don't do that much work because it's, you know, it's a pretty easy community. But I come in, I'm like, oh man, this is like, there's no way this industry will ever get modern because of the way it's built. They said, he's like, every single part's custom. Like you can't. And because it's just how, that's how the industry is, where if I came into that and I see, like, I imagine the same thing, like with pest control. Like when I was talking to my buddy who sold a pest control company, he's like, yeah, I have to know all these like things just in case it does happen. Like I've even seen it here. Like sometimes like something will break down or something will happen in the trampoline park that the new owner has now that you sold to. And it, like calls Raleigh. He's like, hey, how does this get fixed? He's like, what the heck? Like, cause he can't get a hold of the contractor that built the whole thing like a couple of years ago. It's like, oh, that sounds miserable.
And I think the filter is the way that people get messed up is they see something on TikTok and they say, oh, laundromats are easy money. Boring businesses are easy money. So I'm going to do this, not because I love it, not because I'm excited about the opportunity, but I'm doing it because the filter that I have that I'm overlaying on every opportunity is, will this be easy money for me or not? And so I'm saying, I'm saying if you see three laundromat deal in your backyard and you start getting into numbers and you're like, yo, like, I actually think I could do this. Like I can't stop thinking about this. This is what I want to do. Like, I think that that's the right mindset to go in of like, this is exciting to me. I don't think it's going to be easy, but I just have to do it. It's like, this is my deal. This is the thing that it's going to be. I think that's awesome. And I think that if that's the opportunity that you find or it finds you, whatever, like it'll work out and it'll go well. And then it's just a matter of minimizing the most downside risk possible. I just realized the hat that I'm wearing that we never really talked about as I'm looking at myself in the camera and how ridiculous I look as I'm saying something serious. Hey, real quick, if you're a business owner that's doing at least $1 million a year in revenue on a digital or coaching business, we'd love to talk to you. If you go to dealmaven.io and apply on our page, we will get in touch with you and see if we can take your great business and make it even better. But when you see something about how fencing companies are crushing it and you see a fencing deal and you're like, this is going to be such easy money, and you get into it, like, there's just no free lunch. There's no free lunch. And if you're trying to optimize for the easiest thing possible, the easiest way to make money, and I think getting yourself into an opportunity that has like the least natural constraint to scale is apples to apples, a better opportunity than something that is naturally constrained by the labor that you need in order to run the business and fulfill the product. So yeah, do I have less fire in my belly than I did when I was working 80 hours a week at a law firm? For sure. Am I less willing to like kind of eat shit than I was when I was 26 years old trying to figure it out? For sure. But I didn't go into an escape room business because I took a course on it. I mean, I kind of felt like escape rooms were going to be easy, but I kind of came to that conclusion myself. And so I was excited about the idea that like, oh shit, escape rooms crush it. Like, I'm going to crush it on this. And luckily I burned the boats enough that I had no other option. Cause if I had done an escape room on the side, there would have been zero chance that I would have stuck with it. If it wasn't my only way to succeed, then I would have bailed for sure. Cause it just would have been too difficult.
Interesting. Okay. I know I've seen that you've kind of mentioned that you did it in multiple parts, right? Rather than kind of one package. Was that like planned?
Was that wasn't planned. Like, that was an unfortunate mistake. The big mistake that we made in the escape room business and the trampoline park business was we made the assumption that as long as we are more and more profitable year over year, that we will be more and more sellable. And so we never worried about what our exit story was or who our buyer was or what it would potentially look like to sell. We just never thought about any of it. And that was particularly embarrassing for me because I was a merger and acquisition lawyer before doing this. And so I was the guy that was supposed to have everything structurally right and make sure that everything was put in place. So when we kind of started getting the idea that we wanted to sell, the big problem was we were in too many lines of business. We were in an escape room business. We were in a trampoline park business. We were in an axe throwing business. We were in a bar business. We had a product called Labyrinth that we had kind of devved from the ground up that no one had ever done before. And so the reason why it took us so many exits is because I wasn't thinking about the exit until I was ready to exit. That's what ended up being the problem that took me 3 years to get out of. And within that time, COVID hit. And so had I kind of had my ducks in a row and really had a clear idea of what an exit could potentially look like, it probably would have been worth, I don't know if it would have been worth double, but probably another 50% if I had everything structured properly. And so one of the big things that happened as I started talking to investment bankers and big strategic buyers to potentially sell to is there was one business that had sold for a 9x multiple, where most of the time trampoline parks sell for 2 to 4x multiples, trampoline parks, escape rooms, whatever. And so there was one that I found that was selling for 9 times, so more than double. And so I was like, what was so different about them versus what I'm doing right now? And so I found the banker that they had used to do the deal, and I called the banker and I asked them to tell me about the transaction, that I was thinking about doing a transaction myself. And the banker said that the big thing that they did that made their business worth 9x was that they had started to build recurring revenue subscriptions at the gate instead of charging by the hour like everyone else had been doing. You know, we charge 12 or 15 bucks for socks for you to go jump for an hour. And we never tried to build a recurring revenue side of the business. And so that insight of how they had moved their model to that was very different than how we did it, that changed everything, because then we started to implement that as well. And we would have never thought to do it because it actually made us slightly less profitable. We made less money on a monthly basis because all of the power users of people that go to trampoline parks, you know, they get monthly passes instead of paying per use. So I actually made a little bit less money, but it massively increased our exit value because we look less risky to a buyer because there's recurring revenue there. And then, you know, we started tracking what our churn rate was. And then we had to start the disintegration process because all of the people that want to be in the trampoline park business only want to be in the trampoline park business. They don't want to be in the escape room business or the axe throwing business or the nightlife bar business. There was never a buyer that wanted to be in all of the business lines that we had kind of found ourselves in. It was that process of really, really spending the time to do research on the exit. And it was research that, like, I think CEOs have to do on their own. You can't expect a broker to do it. You can't expect a banker to do it. You can't expect somebody outsourced to do it because it really determines the product roadmap of what you're going to continue to build in your business to maximize your exit. And so that took a couple of years for us to kind of like unwind everything that we had built. And so luckily we had started that process when we had enough gas in the tank. If we had just said, hey, like, find us a buyer for this thing, like, we're done, we're checked out, we probably could have gotten $8 to $10 million total. But because we had enough gas in the tank to really retool the business and to turn it into the thing that it needed to look like in order to be attractive to multiple different buyers, you know, that's how we were able to get the 26.
Got it. Okay. And so what do you think now that you saw, okay, you mentioned that, okay, you have to have the pre-plan in place. What do you think people mainly do from what you've seen that they mess up on when trying to kind of set up for their exit?
I think the biggest mistake,
outside of not even planning,
I think the biggest mistake is they just think that if I just make more money, how can I grab money however I can? Because I'm in a bunch of these businesses where it's like attractive character businesses or businesses that are led by one personality or even boring businesses. Like, people just think that if they can drive sales and drive profitability within a short time window, that like automatically translates to them being worth more. And it just doesn't happen. It's not right. In most circumstances, you're better off being less profitable with a strong brand and strong ability to find recurring revenue and like a business model that a buyer finds very safe and predictable for the future. And that just takes time. That takes time to research and to really like get your bearings. In every business, I'll send the CEO of the business, I'll send them weekly reports on businesses that are on the market or businesses that have sold that fit their market segment for potential things that they need to move into and kind of retool the product offering of the business in order to make it more sellable. And so I think some founders feel guilty thinking about selling. There's not a lot of people that you can talk to about it, because like if you tell your COO or your CFO that you're thinking about selling, then they start getting worried about their own job security.
Yeah.
And so when you, as the owner who has the decision, there's not a lot of places that you can go to like talk about it, think about it. Do I want to? Don't I want to? Because like the brokers have a vested interest in you doing it. Your employees have a vested interest in you not doing it. And so all of the kind of decision makers, you kind of have to pick your own destiny and pick the timeline of when you want to do it. And it's very hard if it's your first time going through it to know, is this the right time? Yeah. Or do I wait for another 14 months? Or do I wait for another 3 years? And if I need to wait for 3 years, what do I need to do to it? I just think it's the part of the business cycle that's the most lucrative if done well. And it's the part that's least talked about because so few people who have gone through an exit talk about it. And those people who do talk about it tend to just get like mired down in the mechanics of the transaction, you know, how to calculate seller discretionary earnings and what EBITDA is and all of these things that are like nice to know, but don't really help you in terms of the timing of it. And when do you time it? And how do you capture the momentum that you have and put it into like the most profit maximizing vehicle possible to sell?
Got it. Okay.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about it too in the past. Is like, you've gone and like started structuring other businesses that certain way. Is like, I think a lot of times, you said there's like a fear behind it, or there's like a worry of like, oh, it's like a 3 to 5 year process. Like, I'll worry about it when it gets to that point. Whereas like when you start going down like the actual process of actually, you know, building your business to be exitable, you've mentioned it before, and I've, you know, hearing these people you've talked to in the as well, it's like, oh, I actually enjoy my business. Like, I may not ever want to sell it now because the way it's structured now is like, there's so much security in it. There's so much more, like, I'm not every single week, like wondering, hey, how are we going to get a cash injection? How are we going to go in and do a new product launch? It's like, you have very secure, like the way it's built, because it's obviously you wanted to build it for something. Someone look at it as an investment. It's like, oh, it's really secure business. It's working really well. It's like a machine now.
And yeah.
Now it's actually doing it really well. So I think it's a real big, like, factor in that whole process.
It has to look like an asset, going back to the laundromat thing. A new buyer has to look at it and see this thing can pay for its own management and generate free cash flow outside of it, because there's people in place that can continue to run this thing. But I think it's an important part of the business process. You know, everyone has read Lean Startup or Buy Then Build, or, you know, everything that's kind of like focused on the beginning of the journey. And there's a kind of a dearth of info on the back end of the journey. But if you have a business, so much of your net worth is tied up in that business. People who own businesses, so much of their net worth is tied up in it. And
so as we've been going through, and as I've kind of just been seeing your process of how you've actually been taking the clients and some of the people that you're bringing into your portfolio of actually, you know, I've seen like a couple of calls you've been on where like you get the founder on and like they finally see the actual, like almost like kind of a strategy or like a roadmap to actually like of achieving that exit number we've been talking about finally building. This has been like years and years in the making of the process of like actually getting it out, because you've been like really hesitant on getting this thing out for it. Is an actual like step-by-step system that you have of like what you did with Alcatraz and also like kind of what you're doing with every other portfolio company you bring in called Exit Plan Secrets. And
it's been good to try to formalize that process, because before I've always felt like I've needed to just like get into the details of every person's business and do the research myself. And as I looked back at what I did at Alcatraz and Airborne and what I've done and the other businesses that I've bought into, and I think the businesses that I'm buying right now are the most difficult to find an exit path to, because it's so tied to personal brands. And so really trying to cut away and build a formula for what it looks like to that any business, whether it's brick and mortar or a personal brand, what I would do if I was going through your business and figuring out how can we turn this thing into the most enterprise value maximizing business possible to sell, whether you want to sell it one day or not. And it has very little to do with the operations of the business, and it has a lot to do with who the buyers are in your space, what they're looking for, and what the transactions have looked like recently. It's much more akin to searching Zillow for comparables of what's happening in real estate than it is, you know, being a magician and just being a business model genius or something. And so that whole process of Exit Plan Secrets is actually one of the first courses I ever built back in 2018, or I guess it was 2019, as I was going through the first exit process with Alcatraz. I hadn't focused on it and I hadn't gone through the full transaction. And so I kind of left it. And now that I've been through it enough times, I think that's the thing that people reach out to me for the most. And so I figured I wanted to build a way that was cost effective and as simple as possible to kind of take them through less about the transaction of the exit and more about how to turn your business into an asset, whether you want to exit it or not.
Yeah. And so if you're here on YouTube, watching on YouTube, we'll have like a little link above the screen to go check out this thing called Exit Plan Secrets. And if you're listening, just go to www.dealmaven.io/Exit Plan Secrets.
We'll put the link in the show notes.
And I think real as well with that, like I got a couple of phone calls, a lot of phone calls, you know, with people who are applying to become, you know, part of Deal Maven. And this is going to be the actual like thing that we actually have to, you know, filter through people to give that this then the actual playbook to actually be exit ready. And then once they're ready, you know, like obviously this is like a one way we want to actually be able to get, you know, filter the deal flow and get people actually start in the process so that when we finally get them in, they have everything set and they have like a perfect foundation to be able to actually go and, you know, take that next step of like actually implementing the step-by-step process too.
Yeah. I mean, it's what I do. I was on a call today on my pharmacy business, and it's the exact process that I'm doing right now with the pharmacy business, trying to figure out what needs to happen in the business in order to be able to sell it. I think when it's done, which will be soon, probably this week, it'll be the thing that I give to every portfolio company CEO of the research that they need to be doing to figure out what products, like what their next product roadmap needs to look like in order to sell in the next, you know, 1 to 2 years.
Sick. Cool. Well, we're excited to get something going. And that's the